This is MSCI Perspectives, your source for insights for global investors and access to research and expertise from across the investment industry. I'm your host, Adam Bass, and today is September 18th, 2025. Wealth managers, those who build and manage portfolios for high net worth investors, they've always had to wear many hats, keep a lot of balls in the air. You can pick your own cliche. But no matter how you label it, whether you operate solo or are part of a larger firm, there are portfolios to build and manage, there are clients who need care and feeding, you have to continue to build that client list, and oh yes, there is also the fact that, according to one of our guests today,
the majority of wealth managers in the United States and really around the world today are themselves baby boomers. Within the industry itself, that legacy is being passed on from the generations who started or who established, who have been leading wealth management in the US and globally, are now handing that torch off to the next generation of leaders in the wealth management space.
That is
Govinda Quish. I am the head of wealth product at MSCI.
And Govinda's point is an important one, especially because nothing happens in a vacuum, of course. The rest of the world isn't up on a hook while this all gets sorted. But I'm getting a little ahead of myself here. The baby boomers are indeed a big part of today's story, but it's arguably more important on the client side of the equation.
As everyone really in the wealth management community globally is aware of, the baby boomers, which are the largest wealth accumulators in history, really, are now in the process of passing on that wealth to the next generations. And that is creating a huge shift in how that wealth is invested and the types of expectations that clients have. And then at the same time, we have another very powerful trend that is very complementary, which is technology. And not just technology broadly, but really how wealth management engages and uses technology to provide better, more precise outcomes for their clients, and also how the wealth management industry can create scalability to be able to serve more clients more effectively in how they construct and manage portfolios to meet the needs of those individual clients.
We'll get back to that point about technology more than once in this episode. I promise you that. For now, let's stick with this idea of what's known as the great wealth transfer, as these great wealth accumulators retire and eventually, well, pass on. And for that, we turn to our second guest today, April Rudin, founder and CEO of the Rudin Group, which she started in 2008.
Which some people might think is a pretty lousy year to start a financial services marketing firm, but it ended up being the best time. So for the past 17 years, we've provided strategy in wealth management, wealth tech, fintech, asset management, marketing to global firms, helping them to craft a message, create storytelling and content and visibility for brands all over the world. I blog for Forbes myself for the past many years, and I also have a new book coming out in October of 2025, being published by Wiley, which is called Wealth Management with a Difference. Believe it or not, with all of the changes and factors and things happening, all coming to a head now, there has never been before anything that can be kind of a playbook for wealth management firms. So we set about interviewing 80 plus leaders from small firms, big firms, all across the gamut, trying to get every different perspective. And what really stood out in terms of the interviews is the fact that the time is now. for firms to reposition themselves in terms of brand message, reposition themselves in terms of tech stack, and get ready for the next generation of investors.
But as I was saying, the great wealth transfer.
The great wealth transfer, I think, is an overarching umbrella term that many people are hanging their hats on, but is quite misunderstood by many. At the beginning, when it was spoken about, I think people understood it as a transfer from baby boomers to Gen Z, and that's not happening. That's way too much of an age gap. They really will be transferring their money to Gen X. And Gen X is now, could be up to age 60. So they are reaching their own retirement themselves. I think they're also, these portfolios in general, due to longevity, they're being spent down because people are living longer. They have associated healthcare costs that are, you know, taking their toll on these portfolios. And there's a horizontal transfer that's happening, which is from men to women, because women are generally living longer, between 3 to 5 years, than men. So that transfer is going to go from men to women, and then women to their children.
Horizontal transfer. Didn't see that one coming.
So that is a huge impact. Women represent 51% of the population. Women are creating businesses and creating their own wealth in addition to receiving wealth and wealth transfers from their husbands. And I don't think anyone has played it up well. In other words, women cannot be a tab on your website. Women are not a photo on your website, really. Women are not a brochure, if you follow me. It's not about creating a white paper on women. It's not about having an event for women. It's not, it's just understanding how women want to use their wealth in different ways than men, and looking at their longevity, looking at their values in general. And that really touches on personalization, because you can't serve an entire demographic one way.
So as we all know, in today's world, whether it's how we watch television, how we exercise, how we eat, most of what's happening in our lives today is data-driven, and that technology is using that data to give us better outcomes in those things that we need and how to reach our goals, essentially. So how that applies in the wealth management space is that there's an expectation on the part of the clients that wealth management firms and their advisors will also use data and technology in order to deliver a better experience and outcome. So we have tremendous amounts of data, and allowing that data to inform us and drive the investment and personalization process. Really, it's this notion that and using technology to create personalization at scale. It's leveraging technology in the personalization of how we deliver wealth management and wealth solutions to clients that are highly personalized. And now in the past, right, the challenge has been, if you have, you know, $5 or $6 million, no problem, your advisor can create a highly personalized solution. But if you're one of the mass affluent individuals in our country, and maybe you have a few a few hundred thousand dollars in savings, you're focused on your children's college plan, or maybe your own retirement, or so on, we have to be able to offer the mass affluent within our clients that level of personalization as well. And so what technology now does is it allows you to use the data-driven approach that we have, using large language models, using all of the resources at our disposal, offer a highly personalized solution to individual clients.
I had to wonder, How does this need for better wealth management living through technology square with the fact of what we mentioned earlier about how many advisors themselves are close to retirement? I asked both of our guests about this. Let's start with April, who did not appreciate the premise of my question.
And I really object a little bit there, Adam, to categorizing older people as not being tech savvy, because many people are. And I'm not sure if that's what you meant, but I'm just going to say that I read so many articles where people make that distinction that technology is for younger investors and somehow older people or older, wealthier people don't understand or want technology. And I just want to clear up that myth right here, too. That's not
fair
true.
Enough. Fair enough. Thank you.
That's not true at all. In fact, they might be even more savvy, especially wealthier investors, but they do expect firms to keep up with them. Right. And I think that's where people might be falling down. For many financial advisors, they're used to running their business a certain way, which is getting clients at the golf club, entertaining them over dinner, and getting referrals from friends. And that sort of old-fashioned way of doing business is not the way wealth management runs anymore. It's all about the client experience, the ability to access perhaps alternative investments or access different investments, getting different advice, having something that's more of a holistic financial plan than just investment advice. I think also many financial advisors, they're not so experienced in retirement planning. It also involves decumulation, which is drawing down of assets, whereas most financial advisors have spent their entire lives helping clients to increase, right, accumulate assets. And I think there's an opportunity for some behavioral finance concepts to be included in there too. And these are some of the things that we uncovered in our book, Wealth Management with a Difference.
She went on to explain how one way to think about the idea of personalization, of client experience, is to look to another industry that serves the same client base, namely luxury brands, which have managed to
provide and think about a client experience that's unique and personalized and custom, right from the moment you might enter a store or enter a hotel or so on. They know you. You're not just a number. And I think that more wealth management firms and financial services firms in general can take a page from luxury brands and think about how they are imagining even a client experience.
At this point, I think we need to step back and consider what is a not at all unimportant part of the story. The investment environment in which the great wealth transfer, whether horizontal or vertical, along with the expectation of personalized, technology-driven experiences, is happening. So follow me, if you will, on a slight detour with friend of the pod.
Dimitris Melas, I'm head of multi-asset class investing research at MSCI.
And according to Dimitris, the key word to describe markets today is
uncertainty. And in fact, investors face uncertainty on at least four different fronts. We have policy uncertainty. What will be the likely impact of tariffs? What's the outlook for fiscal policy? How is that going to impact financial markets? We also have institutional uncertainty. The independence of central banks has been called into question. How is that going to affect equity markets, but also fixed income markets in particular? We have, of course, economic uncertainty. What's the likely path for inflation and interest rates? And last but not least, we also have a great deal of technological uncertainty. Will AI investments produce the expected return on investment? This creates an environment of both risks, pitfalls, but also plenty of opportunities for investors in general and for wealth managers.
Okay. He got us back to some positivity there. And actually, despite all of this uncertainty, these potential pitfalls, as he called them, the fact is that markets, while having a relatively shallow drawdown earlier this year,
since then, equity markets have rallied, bond yields generally speaking, have remained relatively stable. And actually, it's quite interesting to note that from the April lows, the rally that we've seen in equity markets, both in the US but also in global equity markets, has been almost as strong as the one after the global financial crisis in 2009 and after the COVID period in early 2020. So the simple explanation behind this market performance is that so far, at least this year, investment and consumption continue to grow. Corporate earnings growth remains robust. And so far, monetary and fiscal policy are broadly supportive for risky assets.
And where is this performance coming from?
In the 15 years from the end of the global financial crisis until, let's say, the end of 2024, until the end of last year, U.S. equities really dominated and outperformed international and emerging markets by quite a big margin. So actually, during this 15-year period, U.S. equities outperformed by approximately 7% per annum. So if you were sitting anywhere outside the U.S. investing in U.S. equities, you were enjoying, obviously, substantial equity market performance and also getting some additional returns from dollar appreciation. And the reason why I explain all of this is because we've seen the exact opposite play out this year. This pattern has been turned on its head. We've seen international and emerging market equities outperform the U.S. The market performance in local currency terms is relatively small, but then we had quite significant depreciation in the U.S. dollar. So in dollar terms, the gap between in U.S. equities and international emerging market equities so far this year has been quite substantial. This change in the market environment makes diversification far more important.
Much like those differences in performance, where you are in the world may determine how wealth managers put that diversification strategy into action. One asset class that's gaining a big head of steam, especially outside the U.S.,
is the use of private assets and structured products. And so by private assets, I'm talking about private credit, private equity, real estate and real estate investment vehicles, so non-listed private assets. It used to be that if you wanted to be invested in private real estate and private equity and private credit and these private assets, on average, maybe your net worth was, you know, 5 to 10 million. Today, what we're seeing a very strong theme around is the asset management companies, whether it's groups like Blackstone or KKR or you name any of them out there, they're creating investment vehicles to give exposure to those private assets at a much lower price point. So now you're seeing model portfolios come out from groups like BlackRock that instead of being just 60-40 with equity and fixed income, they're now adding 5 to 10% private assets into that mix and reducing some of the equity exposure, reducing some of the traditional fixed income exposure in order to add in those private assets. Now, what that comes along with is the necessity to have a portfolio management system that can work with those exposures, that can give you proper risk management, that can give you proper portfolio analysis, scenario analysis, can do the proper analysis that allows for those private assets to be brought in to give the client a complete picture of what their exposure is and what their risks and sources of return are.
In the last couple of years, we have seen the development of new access vehicles that actually make it much easier to invest in private assets. And as a result, I think private assets are likely to play a bigger role in wealth portfolios going forward. And of course, it's important to emphasize that exposure to private equity, private credit is not a silver bullet, right? It will not magically improve returns and lower risks. That doesn't happen. Adding private equity and private credit to a multi-asset portfolio brings performance and diversification benefits, but it also exposes the portfolio to some unique risks associated with private markets. For example, funding risk, liquidity risks. These are not risks that people tend to think about when investing in public markets. Wealth managers need to be equipped, obviously, with the right knowledge, understanding, but also analytical tools to be able to assess and manage these unique risks in a total portfolio context.
For firms looking for global success with high net worth clients, some of that new knowledge and understanding involves
being very facile and agile and ability to create different types of portfolios and different kinds of investments and strategies, and also just plain advice will separate sort of firms out from those who will be more successful globally versus those who will be less successful globally. It's really important to understand how different cultures play into this. For example, one of the things in the book that we uncovered and that we spoke about is the one child rule in China for retirement. So, you know, that has really negatively played into Chinese retirement because there simply are not enough kids or younger generations or people there now due to the restrictions on childbearing. And so they have a huge country with aging population and not enough people to take care of the older people. Contrast that with, you know, locally Hong Kong, which has just gotten very expensive over post-pandemic, and people are finding it unaffordable to retire in Hong Kong and are moving cross-border to Shenzhen. But that's just one example, and making sure that advisors, systems, and then compliance and regulatory is also up to speed in understanding what all these different jurisdictions require and managing across, you know, time zones, right, and across jurisdictions.
Earlier, I promised you many bites at the role of technology, Apple, and here comes another one. One that in many ways brings together a lot of what we've talked about today. Govinda and Dimitris alluded to it when they spoke about how wealth advisors require new tools to analyze and communicate with clients in a way that takes into account longer retirements, complex wealth transfers, expectations about personalization, and new types of investments such as private assets. Now, this is a tool that many institutional investors have relied upon for years, but technology, especially generative AI, have made even more powerful. It's known as stress testing or scenario analysis. And here's a little about why it works.
Investors increasingly realize that relying on a single view and reflecting that single view in your portfolio can be dangerous. It's a high-stakes game. Obviously, it's great if your view turns out to be correct, but it could be disastrous if it turns out to be wrong. On the other hand, if you formulate scenarios, translate them into market impacts or CMAs, as we call them, capital market assumptions, what that allows you to do is examine portfolios under these different scenarios, and it gives investors a lot more flexibility in making decisions. It also may help to identify opportunities that could have non-symmetric payoffs, as we say. In other words, changing positions or adding assets that could provide, on one hand, limited downside in a bad scenario, but could give you a lot of upside in another scenario.
Govinda explained how that applies specifically to the wealth management industry.
In asset management, you're building out a portfolio, whether it's an ETF or a mutual fund or a private equity or private credit fund, you're building funds. Within the asset management space, the core role and work that you're doing is to create investment vehicles. Your clients for those investment vehicles might be pensions and sovereign wealth funds. They might be different types of institutional investors, but the largest market in the world is wealth management. Wealth management professionals, investment advisors, then put those products into their client portfolios. Now, where that scenario analysis has been most commonly used over the years is in that asset management space at the portfolio level. So they use that in order to understand what the strengths and vulnerabilities are of that portfolio. Now, let's take that and move it into the wealth management ecosystem. What changes very, very drastically in the wealth management ecosystem is now you're not dealing with one portfolio and you're not doing scenario analysis on a fund, an ETF, a mutual fund, a private credit fund, or so on. You're doing that scenario analysis on a client household. And you do then, if you drill down into that household, there might be multiple portfolios. So your average client household might be, there's a husband who has various investments. There might be the wife with hers. And then maybe they have some joint accounts in those portfolios. There might be multiple accounts. Now, when it comes to the goals and where that household is in its life cycle, is it a young family who you have, you know, a lawyer and a software developer with two very young kids, and where they are in the life cycle of their investment decision-making is very different than, say, you're a household and you're an older couple. The kids have been through college and you're about, as a couple, to go into your decumulation phase. Right now, depending on whether you're that young couple with young kids who have many years till they go to college, or you're the couple whose kids have already left college and you're looking at retirement, how you define risk is very different. And so what the scenarios are that might impact you is going to be very different, portfolio by portfolio and across different households. In order to do that well, it's actually quite simple and quite elegant if you have the right technology.
Right. And an Excel spreadsheet is definitely not going to cut it here.
Yeah, but you'd be surprised what people try to do. But yes, it's not cutting it. And that's, you know, now a challenge is a lot of the wealth technology that's out there today has been around for 25, 30, sometimes more years. And the underlying code base of that technology, the infrastructure, the architecture, simply can't accommodate what needs to be done in order to provide the needs of these clients today. So we're really going to see new technologies come in. We're going to see new companies emerge, and we're going to see old companies fall away if they don't adopt, because the technology that's needed for where the wealth management space is going, and really where it is right now, is 100% different than the technology that was required 10 or 15 years ago, even. Now, if you layer in there the use of large language models that are now writing code, and you layer in there the engineers that know how to skillfully use those large language models that are writing 80, 90% of the code, and how quickly those models that are writing the code, the agents that are writing the code, how quickly they're learning to write code skillfully, efficiently, and without errors is staggering. And so in 5 years from now, when we look back, a huge amount of the technology that we look at today is going to have been rebuilt in ways that create efficiencies and scalabilities that sitting where we are today is hard to imagine. The transformation that's going to take place is staggering.
With the advent of AI, agentic AI, large language models, and so on, is going to be changing the client experience much more quickly than we've ever experienced in the past. It's going to look much more personalized and customized and less regimented, less programmatic than what we see now. So having AI and different reg tech solutions will help firms create different product sets and regulate those in ways that we're not aware of right now and roll it out in a much quicker way. People always use the term client-centric as if that has a particular definition and it's not just sort of lip service. And I think that actually what we're going to see in the near term future is more and more wealth management being offered in a much more client-centric way instead of a firm-centric sort of a way.
That's all for this episode. Our thanks to Govinda, April, and Demetris. And don't forget April's book, Wealth Management with a Difference, Your Guide to Achieving Client, Generational, and Business Success, drops, as the kids say, on October 14th. So depending when you're listening to this, you can either order or pre-order right now. You'll also find a further breakdown and analysis of the latest wealth management trends at MSCI.com. Next up on the program, how are investors around the world approaching all of that uncertainty Demetris was talking about? We'll hear views from attendees at MSCI's Investment Risk Summits in London and New York. Until then, I'm your host, Adam Bass, and this is MSCI Perspectives. Thanks for listening.